Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Technology Leaders.
Lee Cantor here with James Douglas from Bandicutters, another episode of Atlanta Technology Leaders. Welcome, James.
Welcome. Thank you very much.
So anything new this week happening over there at Bandicutters?
Yeah, we've had some really interesting clients come through the door, some really exciting stuff happening.
Cool. But today is a big day because we got the Atlanta Technology Leadership.
Indeed.
We got quite a crowd. We're going to start with Andrew Ryan, and then after him we'll get to Tarby Bryant at Gathering of Angels and Jason Michaud at Max Stadium. But first, it's Andrew Ryan, Member Suite. Welcome, Andrew. How are things?
Things are great, Lee. Thanks for having me. It's great to meet you and James, and what you guys are doing here is pretty impressive.
Now, Member Suite, can you share a little bit about what you guys are up to?
Sure. Well, Member Suite makes software for modern associations. Ultimately, what we do is we help associations and nonprofits automate their back-end processes and provide a way for their members to communicate with their associations.
And how'd you get into this?
Well, you know, I think like most entrepreneurs, I kind of tripped and fell into it. Out of college, I was working for a startup and then did some consulting for Goldman Sachs, who was on the board of an association. And when I got there, they were in a lot of pain around just management and web presence stuff. And, you know, they were paying somebody, you know, some ridiculous amount of money to custom build what they needed. And I remember actually saying, I actually uttered the words, I think I'm in the wrong business. And that was 2003, and the rest is sort of history.
So now, what's the challenge that associations have?
Well, associations, particularly when they get large being, you know, more than 10, 15 staff, more than a million in revenue, have a ton of processes for which there's no equivalent in the for-profit world. So they have membership and renewals that they have to manage,
right?
Billing and dues, conferences and meetings from which they derive a significant portion of their revenue and they depend on certifications. I mean, the list goes on. And, you know, solutions like Salesforce, while they're great in their own right, are ill-equipped to deal with the requirements.
The unique challenges of the association,
exactly,
right?
Exactly. So we deliver what they need on a software as a service platform.
Now, what about, do you help with their events? Because a lot of associations have conferences and events.
Sure. So, you know, we have an ecosystem through our API where providers who will actually, we do provide their software for their events. We do allow them to manage registration and sign up and so forth. But the folks that go on site and kind of wear the polos with the logos on the elbow and do your actual, your event management and staffing are different. They get hired outside of us, but they interface with our software.
So it is seamless, like in terms of, you know, if they have to sell tickets to the event and things like that, or get sponsorship and things.
Exactly, yeah. They can do that and track all of that through our software.
So now, what's the biggest challenge for you guys? Is it just telling the associations you exist?
Well, I think,
because I would think that they're pretty hungry for a solution like this, because a lot of associations, at least the ones we come in contact with, are kind of volunteer. There's a lot of, you know, transition amongst people. So it seems like they're recreating a wheel.
Yeah,
constantly.
Absolutely. And, you know, we find that the association and nonprofit market will lag the for-profit market in terms of the technology they're willing to absorb and accept by 5 to 7 years. And so, you know,
5 to 7 years?
5 to 7 years, aye, man.
Aye.
I remember, and I'm telling you, I remember having conversations where people would tell me they don't want a web-based software product. They want a thick client. They want it to be installed and run in Windows. And, you know, so we're just getting to a place now where people are comfortable with, and really comfortable, and actually prefer a SaaS solution that runs in the cloud where they don't have to manage and have to run any software on their servers.
Or not have updates, and like it all just happens.
Sure. And I think what's even more important is the multi-tenancy, the fact that, you know, we're SaaS and we are providing a service to multiple associations on one platform. It allows us to really rapidly innovate and realize the true value of a service delivery model.
Right.
So if you look at a lot of our competitors, they're delivering software every 3 years. Well, kind of a lot's happened in the last 3 years,
yeah,
right? And nobody really delivers software like that anymore. And so I think really adopting the modern model of software delivery is the biggest challenge. Getting the market comfortable with that is what's interesting for us right now.
And do you find that associations coming back to you saying they want to do something that there's nothing yet built for? Because a lot of what you said before is almost things that they're doing perhaps inefficiently, do they come to you with much innovation?
Every day, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, like every day, like on the car ride here, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know.
On the car ride here, somebody called you?
Yeah, we get emails. There's something, and, you know, I've been in this market probably 13 years now, and I still get surprised constantly about the things that they want to do. And, you know, that's fine. I mean, we want to position associations to innovate and serve their members, right? And, you know, some of our customers, they seem very esoteric, but they have large and important membership. So what we've had to do is build a solution flexible enough to be able to meet the needs that we can anticipate and even the ones that we can't.
Now, do you have a sweet spot in terms of size of members for an association?
More staff, right? Because if you're a trade association, you might have 15 members, but they might all be oil companies. So, you know, you've got a ton of money, right? And so we typically are focused right around anywhere from 10 to 50 staff associations. They tend to really need what we've got. Smaller than that, they can usually pigeonhole with access or even, you know, like a sales force or a smaller product. Larger than that, and they typically have their own IT team and want to build their own stuff.
Right. That's just unique to them.
Right.
Now, do you work with those, you know, there's companies that their job is to run associations?
Yes, we do. We have several. They're called association management companies. Uh-huh. And we have several customers.
So that's a niche for you that you create something for them to offer that they kind of white label over your stuff?
Yeah, I mean, and it turns out to be really handy because if you are in the business of managing associations and you've got 10 clients, well, you know, a SaaS solution is really ideal for you.
It's perfect.
You want to log in one place and be able to switch to multiple instances and clients, and that's something we offer out of the box.
Now, are there a lot of those association management?
There are, and there's actually an association for association management companies. It's called IAMC, or the Association Management Institute. And yeah, there are a lot of those, and they are really a great sort of channel for us as we grow.
And then when you're working with these different groups, what is something like, how did this start? And then what was the first iterations of it? Like what was the first things you solved?
Well, I think out of the gate membership, right? So the complexity around, you know, at the time I first iteration of the software was a custom build that I had built
for an association.
Yeah. For one association in DC. And, you know, I was 23 years old and it was sort of my first attempt
at doing
anything.
So it was like a year or two ago.
It was a little bit more than a year or two ago, but it wasn't the 90s. So I'll give you that over under. But, you know, we solved membership first, right? I mean, they had 10,000 members that were renewing on a regular basis, and they had to keep track of their
and
dates.
They ran out of index cards.
And they ran, and you joke about that, but that's what they did before software came along, right? I mean, they used index cards in filing cabinets. Right? You know, I'm a member of a fraternity, Alpha Phi Alpha. It's the first Black Collegiate fraternity. Martin Luther King was a member, Thurgood Marshall, and you know, they actually use an earlier version of my software. And before, you know, we got to them, they had a rack of index cards. So people who paid in the 60s, 50s, 40s, you know, right?
Their cards are yellowed and frayed.
Yeah, right? Yeah. I mean, you wouldn't believe, right? It's sort of in a basement there. And it's just really interesting what they come from and what they are looking to do today.
So the first iteration was, okay, let's just have a way to keep track of them and make sure they paid, make sure that we have the updated address and email and whatever their contact.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then I think the next iteration was, okay, we're spending a lot of money answering the phone, right? You know, members want to be able to update their information. You know, in 2003, that was sort of a something we thought was a good idea. Now it's a foregone conclusion. You don't even think about it anymore. And so enabling their members to self-serve and, you know, communicate and manage their relationship with the association without having to pick up a phone.
Mm-hmm. And how do you find in terms of their absorption of the offering that you give them? Is it they can get it within a first month? Does it normally take them 6 months to fully start using all the modules that you've got available? What's their adoption kind of period like?
That's a really great question. You know, it really depends on the association. So, you know, some of our modules like certifications, right, are targeted at associations who certify people to do things. Mm-hmm. Okay. So a lot of what the association is challenged with is rethinking how they do their processes now that there's a system, right?
Right.
There's no more index cards, right? So
is disruptive to an organization. You got to help them through to manage that change,
exactly,
right?
Exactly, right? And so sometimes, you know, we sit and a lot of times we're refereeing debates internally,
right?
About what they
now you started
do.
Some trouble, right?
Right. You know, we've got to kind of grab Jake off of Jack. You know what I mean?
Jake loves the index cards.
Yeah.
His brother-in-law sells index cards.
Yeah. And the board approved this, even though he did love index cards.
Right.
And so there's some issues there. So I think, That's a really interesting. It really depends on how open and how receptive they are to a new system and how much they've thought through the way that they'll use it. It could be we've taken people live in 4 weeks. I mean, I've sat in meetings where, you know, we've declared that a customer is going live, and I'm kind of like, didn't we just sign them last week? And then there's been customers that take 6 months, right? So it just depends.
Mm. Now, you give them the software. They have to input all the names, or do you help them with that side as well?
Well, at our size, we have to do the data migrations because they're usually sophisticated enough where they can't just re-enter it in. They can't just re-enter in 18,000 records. And that's just another challenge, something that makes us different. As a SaaS company, we actually have the ability to import whatever data that they have. And they are usually bringing data in from all kinds of different systems that may or may not be related and may or may not be clean. And so that's just a challenge, something we overcome in our daily course.
And you have someone in your team that's really good at reading handwriting.
We have somebody on our team that is really good at data, for sure. Yeah. Yeah.
Andrew, what about churches? Have you looked at their associations?
Absolutely. And they face a lot of the same challenges. You know, we've definitely considered the megachurch as a niche market that we want to go after. We don't have them now. They have unique things that they do that we just haven't built our product to be able to do. But we definitely see it as a route of expansion for the company.
So 800 member, I'm up in Big Canoe, and we've got 800 members of our chapel. Mm-hmm. And I suspect we're on index cards.
You might be.
See that?
Yeah, Andrew, you might be.
Tarby's helping you out here.
Yeah, we would probably have to target our offerings at, I guess, what would be called a mega church. So mm-hmm. if you've got 5,000, 10,000 members that you have to manage.
But isn't it more staff, or you think it would be different in that case? Like, you were going by staff of the administrative staff.
Yeah, I mean, so if you could solve your problems with one or two staff members, we might not give you the sort of ROI that or right. the value proposition might be out of whack for what you would justify right. a software purchase like ours. But when you start to get to 10 staff to manage your operations, that's when we really start to really help
right.
you.
And that's where the mega church might fit in.
Yeah,
and also in those environments, I mean, it's not a kind of type of business that I'm unfamiliar with. They often have more staff mm-hmm. than they probably need.
Yeah.
And this politely could mm-hmm. be a way of them, let's say, refocusing their human resources.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when I first started out, I remember one of the modules we have is exhibits. So when you are an association, you have a trade show and right. there's a floor and people buy booths. There was a person whose only job was to kind of like keep track of that. They had a big poster in their office. And they had
they put stickers.
They had pin-its for every booth that was purchased. Right. And that was all they did 24/7. And so what we like to do is be able to take that person and free them from the mundane task, right? So that they can think strategically. Now I can think about how I can make, you know, how I can increase our booth sales.
Right.
I don't have to worry about taking orders. And so that's just how we like to help associations.
And just in terms of the market size, is it the kind of business where you can say, right, I'm only going to stick in Florida? That's where it was, in Georgia. Or is it the kind of thing where you say, right, I need to be kind of fully open to services across America?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, and there's 150,000 associations in the United States.
150,000.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
Is there that many things?
Oh, you wouldn't believe.
What's the craziest association you've heard of?
Oh man, you know there. It might be the alpaca owners and breeders. I mean, they were just great folks.
The alpaca owners yeah. and breeders.
Yeah,
association.
I met them probably about 10 years ago, and they're just great people. And
how
I'll tell
many
you,
are there?
I learned a lot about them.
Is there 100?
No, there are thousands.
Thousands
of people.
They were a fairly wealthy organization.
Wow.
Really smart people, and I just learned a lot about alpaca and silk making, right? I mean, it's a whole subculture you don't know anything about.
Right.
Subculture.
Yeah.
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 Wow.
But they have problems too, right? And that's why yeah. we're here.
Yeah. Now, the association, how techie do they have to be to implement this? Or is this like anybody can, like once you put the software in their system, anybody can do this, or
anybody
they need like an IT person?
Yeah, anybody can do it. I mean, I think one of the things that, you know, the old school software companies do is they expose sort of the guts of software to the user. You got to go run a SQL query, or you got to go run a right. stored procedure, and it makes it necessitate somebody full time on staff who knows that stuff, and it shoots your total cost of ownership through the roof. One of the things we want to do is we want to start from the user experience, right? We consider that to be our core competency. We have a director of UX on staff, and we want to figure out how to make this usable by somebody who does not know SQL,
right?
And that's one of the keys for our market and our segment and serving them well.
Right. And especially if you get into the churches or something like that, where sure. that's not super techie, and it could sure. be this person who's volunteering there, and now they're in charge of the software.
Yeah. Absolutely. And so, you know, the challenge is to make it and to make it easy for them to use and make, you know, support an afterthought, you know, because the product guides itself.
Right.
And I imagine if you're saying that they're a little bit perhaps slower than others to adapt to new technology, that the conversation is probably at the moment, or it's been for a while in terms of web applications. Do you find they're now starting to ask questions about making their offering into kind of mobile? Is that something that's now happening?
Yeah, that's
it. How are you finding that journey? Because that's a different journey.
Yeah, and it's happening now, right? People are asking us, hey, we want to be SaaS. That's a requirement now. Mm-hmm. Whereas 5 years ago, I had to convince
people that
it wasn't gonna, you know, that it wasn't less secure. And now they're talking about mobile. They're talking about responsive design.
Right.
They're talking about how to make sure they're engaging their members and how to quantify their members' participation and understand their success year over year. And this is great for us, right? Because what it does is it allows us to be in a position of thought leadership. We can innovate, deliver on that, and show the market the right way to do it. And it's just a huge opportunity for where we are right now.
So you currently have that. That's available right now, mobile?
We're releasing an engagement module that is one of the biggest things on our roadmap. And the mobile component is on our roadmap for 2015.
So you're in kind of high growth mode here, expanding.
Absolutely. You know, we just raised the round of venture capital, which closed $4.5 million from a bunch of really great investors. I think when you're trying to build a company, particularly a SaaS company, one of the things people don't understand is the capital intensity of it and how different it is from, say, you know, an Instagram or a Snapchat.
Right.
You know, an enterprise B2B company just takes a lot of infrastructure to get off the ground. I like to say, if your local McDonald's, you know, pays $100,000 a month to serve 10,000 customers, that doesn't mean they could serve 10 people for $1 a month, right? It takes a certain amount of money to make one French fry, right? And so
that's the most expensive one.
Exactly. All right, exactly. And the second one is bad, and the third one, at some point, you make money. If for a SaaS company, you need the support and success team. You need an functioning engineering organization. You need a functional operational organization. You might need a services organization. So, you know, the biggest reason we raise capital is to be able to service our customers better, right? To build those organizations before the customers came. And so, you know, we've been fortunate enough to get investors who understand that. And we, you know, we're kind of in high growth mode right now, just kind of.
So you're hiring right now?
We're hiring in a big way, right? We're hiring a lot for a lot of different things. One of the great things about Atlanta, I think somebody asked me why I moved from D.C., which is where the company was founded, is there's such great talent here. You know, in D.C., as great a place as it was, and I enjoyed it, we had such a hard time finding talent that we actually classified it as a risk to our business. Right?
Really? Wow. But you had a lot of associations. There are tons based there.
Right, right. And so that's where the logical place is to be. But, you know, when we wanted to go hire engineers and we wanted to go hire customer success and marketing, it was very difficult to find. Whereas in Atlanta, it's really sort of plentiful. I mean, you put a job rec out, you hire a recruiter. 2 weeks later, you got like the best person you ever interviewed in your life sitting in your office. So
you're pleased with your move?
Sure,
to Atlanta.
Yeah, absolutely.
What sort of valuation do you have currently?
Well, you know, we've been really aggressive in our valuation, and I think this last round we've done a seed round and we've done an A round, and so this last round was about 40% more than the seed round, and it was 6 months later. So just in that 6 months, we've increased the value of the business by 40%. Our original investors have been really happy about that.
So what is it today?
Well, I'd rather not share that. We are kind of, you know, bound by sharing.
Hang in there, Toby. You might have to get this off.
This is not a private conversation. I will pass.
Tarby has a group called Gathering of Angels. So he's very interested in things like your company.
He's just circled your name on his piece of paper.
So now what's next for you guys? You're just kind of hanging on for dear life in terms of the growth?
Yeah, I mean, the growth has been interesting, right? And making sure we're able to scale and handle that, right? You know, you can sort of grow too quickly and grow yourself out
you
of business.
You got to manage that.
And I think the infrastructure needed to support that is our top priority right now, making sure we have a repeatable process that can churn out happy customers on a regular basis. I also think innovation, right, is our core competency. So continuing to push the envelope on mobile, on what we call association intelligence, right, AI, on experience and responsive design is just going to be something we're going to be really focused on. You're also going to see us do some new things next year. You're going to see us have our first customer conference, right? You're going to see us with three major functional releases of major new functionality with webinars and marketing go around it. So we're really excited about what's happening in the company and the direction we're going.
Now, can you share a tip for a company that's going through what you're going through right now? Is there anything that you've learned that you can help somebody else out?
You know, It's really interesting. For a SaaS company, I'll say, you know, I'll make the joke and I'll say, look, I've got a scotch in my office, right? But what I'm really saying is the thing that they don't tell you about when you're an entrepreneur and the challenge that you face is managing your own psychology, right? Managing your own doubts, your own fears, your own need to lead, your own need to succeed, and being able to sort of keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you, but trusting yourself when all investors doubt you, right? And make allowances for their doubting too. So, you know, I think the tip I would give is hang in there, right? I mean, you know your market, you know your product, you understand in a way deeper than anybody else the value proposition that you're bringing. And it's not going to be easy, but if you really hang in there and you really work towards giving, making your customers happy and building a quality product, you'll find success and everything will follow.
Good stuff, good stuff. Well, we appreciate you being here and sharing your story.
Thanks, I appreciate being here. I love it.
And
one more tip for him. 2 weeks ago, I went to the North Point Church up in Alpharetta.
Okay.
They serve 24,000 people per Sunday.
Interesting.
So you're talking about a large group of folk.
That's
and
a
he
big
has
church.
He has five churches. Andy Stanley is your contact.
All right. Well, you know, got to slide me a napkin.
And website for you guys?
www.membersuite.com.
And then you're looking for associations with 10 or more employees?
Yeah, 10 or more staff is our niche.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being part of the show today.
Thank you.
All right, Tarby. I know you were chomping at the bit.
Always.
Always. Tarby Bryant, Gathering of Angels. How you doing, Tarby?
I'm well, sir.
Anything new happening in your world, in your gathering?
Yeah, we are doing meetings once a month here in Atlanta now. I moved from Santa Fe, New Mexico about 2.5 years ago.
Right.
Living up in Big Canoe, and we just had one of our monthly Gathering of Angels last night at the Georgian Club and had five wonderful presenters and 40 angel investors in the room writing checks and drinking wine.
Now, why don't you share a little bit about your vision of Gathering of Angels and how it came about?
Started October 1996 in Santa Fe. I was doing economic development effort for Los Alamos National Laboratories and helping commercialization from some of the lab rats, as we affectionately call them. And I realized that there weren't any angel groups in New Mexico. Read about one called the Band of Angels in California and modeled the Gathering of Angels after them. And we've done 384 funding so far since October of 1996, ranging from 20,000 to 39 million.
And at the event, I was privileged enough to attend an event a while ago, but it's the company gets to go up there and talk for what period of time?
Yeah, the companies find me usually by web search or by referral, and they come for practice sessions from 2 to 5. Mm-hmm. So yesterday afternoon, I'm the Marine Master Sergeant putting them through what I think will help them raise money. So from 2 to 5, they practice. And the event itself is from 5 to 8. Each company has 20 minutes to tell the story with PowerPoint, followed by 2 to 5 minutes of Q&A. Mm-hmm. And then all of the angel investors in the room fill out an evaluation sheet, Lee, that you may remember.
Yes.
And this, I've heard twice last night, is probably the most valuable thing that I provide to the presenters. So they know immediately, usually 3 to 5 minutes after their presentation, the Q&A session, who's interested and who's not, and who they want to set up breakfast, coffee, or lunch with the next day.
And then is there a fee for the presenter?
Yeah. The angel investors, VCs, and investment bankers come complimentary. Each of the presenters pays a one-time fee of $2,500 with no percentage of money raised, and it's SEC approved.
Mm-hmm. So then they pay, and then they don't have to give anything to the organization if there's any funding occurs.
There's no success fee. I'm not a broker dealer, and so this is the way I've been doing it. After a visit from the SEC, I play by their rules.
And is there particular kind of industries that you look at and focus on?
I go all the way, Andrew, from bed and breakfasts to restaurants to hotels to software.
That's right. It's not just technology. I think when I was there, it was like an oil drilling company.
Yeah.
Like anybody could be there, right?
Well, anybody that I can understand their executive summary and their business model. I'm a finance professor, so if I can't understand it, my angels certainly can't understand it. But I don't do gambling and sex websites.
Right.
Everything else is open.
So it's
game.
Fair game, right?
Yeah, I've done it all.
And then and they can be pre-revenue or they can't be pre-revenue?
All the way from pre-revenue, back of the napkin, all the way up through publicly traded companies that are doing pipes.
And these and the people that are coming, you said they go across all the different industries, but are there particular kind of connection points? Is there particular areas of success that you've had more than others? Because generally there's more, the audience know a particular market better than others and therefore more free to invest in the market that they know.
I would say sometimes, but I've had people that say I do nothing but automotive, and they'll come and write a $400,000 check to a bed and breakfast in another state.
That's right. It's serendipity is a funny thing, isn't it? You put a bunch of people, smart people, in a room. You don't know what's going to happen at the end of the night.
You mix that with wine, which is the elixir of finance, I call it.
That was a lesson learned, right?
Scotch.
That was a lesson learned to add alcohol to this mix.
Yeah. Well, you know, it works at charity all. It certainly works at the Gathering of Angels. And I can usually tell last night we poured 60 glasses of wine.
Wow. So,
as long as the signature on the check is legible. I think there has to be a line there.
Yeah. I think the check's got to clear.
Yeah, there we go.
Check's got to clear.
So now you have a new book here, and you were kind enough to give to us The Entrepreneur's Guide to Raising Capital from Angel Investors. What was the impetus for that?
I got a call actually last September from Wiley & Sons out of New York, a book publishing company, and they said, Mr. Bryant, would you be interested in writing a book about what you've been doing for a long time? And I said, sure. I signed a contract, promised them 60,000 words, and then I wrote for 4 months during the winter and lots of wine up in the hills of North Georgia. And when I finished, I had 23,500 words. They said, write some more filler. I said, you know, I'm dry. There's nothing else. I don't do charts. I don't do graphs.
Right.
Entrepreneurs won't read much. And so I finally found a local Marietta publisher, and so they published the book, and it's distributed through Ingram, and it's on Amazon and Barnes & Noble.
Right, so then they can go to Amazon and probably just Google Tarby Bryant, just search for Tarby Bryant, you'll find it.
Yeah, and you can do the same thing down the street at Barnes & Noble. It's just not on the shelf is kind of the way, but if you go in, go on their computer, and you pull it up, and it'll can order it.
And then this is the how-to guide for somebody that has the idea on the napkin?
That on the napkin or in a business plan or as far down the road and looking for another round of capital with suggestions on valuation methodologies, suggestions on executive summaries and exit strategies.
So can you talk a little bit about that? How does a company value itself when it's pre-revenue?
Usually on projections. I like to look at 3 to 5 year projections. I take the net operating income after tax and multiply that times an industry multiple and then bring it back to present value, usually at a 40% internal rate of return. That's the discounted cash flow methodology.
You buying that, Andrew? You're the one who's going through it.
Yeah, I guess the question I would have is what about a company that didn't have a revenue model, right? Like if you're Instagram and you just have, you know, something that's taken off but you haven't figured out how to monetize it yet, how do you think about your valuation?
Well, if you haven't done projections, I can't give you a valuation. But most of the companies last night asked me, you know, Tarby, what do I have to give up to raise my $500,000?
Right. So you're there available for coaching in that regard, right?
If they ask, I will help them, as I did last night, for a wedding venue in Buford, Georgia. Mm-hmm. A young couple just got engaged, and they want to rent a beautiful historic home. And they had projections, and I basically did their valuation at $300,000 net present value. And then suggested instead of raising $300,000, they would lose 100% of their company. I suggested that they raise $130,000, get some milestones, get some accomplishments, and then come back for a second round, as you've done.
And within this scene, I think it's fascinating when you get perhaps the friends and family round, and you're being asked to invest in a company, and if that company is one that's going to require an awful lot, to perhaps three rounds to actually get to an exit, you're aware that the last person in has probably got the most power to then define what their first people in got.
Sure.
What would you say to someone that is considering a first round, you know, investment? Because it's far more risky than perhaps a round, you know, third round, fourth round.
Well, you have to basically, you know, either negotiate or accept what they offer. But certainly you can negotiate some ratchet clauses and basically protection against dilution, which is the risk of an early investor. Mm. But, you know, it's high risk, high return. Most of them are looking for a 35 to 45% return on their money per year at the angel round.
Now, you're doing gathering of angels not just – financially, this is an important subject for you, right? This is good for the economy. This is good for America to invest in these companies of this stage.
Yeah, and they're one or two groups across the country that do this, but you know, most of them are run by, you know, Harvard MBAs that have never been in business. And I've been doing angel investing since I was 7 years old. I had a firecracker business that blew up in the backyard.
Literally.
blew up. And so I've been starting businesses all my life. I ran a movie business out of my basement on West Wesley. And, you know, I started my first real business out of graduate school. An automobile leasing business. So I've been doing a lot of different kind of businesses all my life, and I love it. And I've invested in 16 of my young companies and probably will continue to do it until
and
I check out.
It's rewarding to see them come to fruition and the ideas, you know, actually turn into something and an ongoing entity.
Well, a lot of them will just die if they don't raise capital.
Right.
And they can't,
it's important.
They can't go to the bank anymore without, you know, 3 years of, you know, profitability and audited statements and things like that. And so an angel investor, and I have a mix between probably 70% angel investors, one or two VCs, and some investment bankers who actually do the big deals. The $39 million came from an investment banker who was sitting in the audience and heard about an adult a limited facility down in Henry County. And raised $6 million in equity and the balance of it in 4% coupon debt for 10 years for one of the companies that presented.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And do you find that there's a difference as a statesman in the field? Do you find that the kind of companies that are being pitched to people like you is changing in the last 10, 20 years? Is it 20 years ago you'd never see these types of businesses in terms of what they're expecting and what they're presenting?
It's almost the same, you know, before the recession, after the recession, during the recession. I had fewer companies that could even come up with a presentation fee during the presentation, but I kept doing it, even if I had one or two presenters. But I had a company last night fly all the way from Copenhagen, Denmark, that had a search engine for business companies, articles, and executives called MasterSeek. And they had a $100 million valuation. They were looking for $10 million.
Wow.
And he flew all the way from Copenhagen.
Mm. And then what happened?
Was he happy when he flew back?
He is going to stay for a week and follow up. That's why I didn't bring a guest along today, is that they're all in follow-up mode, as I instruct them to do. I've had companies that make great presentations, and then they get on the midnight plane to Georgia or back to Arizona or somewhere and don't get any money. So, you know, I both require that they come for practice sessions and that they spend at least the next day in follow-up sessions with the people that fill out the investor profile forms.
Mm. Yeah, I would imagine follow-up is the key.
That's the art of the deal.
Right, you're not going to get the deals done. Now, is there any tips you would have for somebody who's going through the process other than buy your book?
The book is secondary. The business plan is probably the most critical element in the process. And it's always evolving. Somebody said, well, I'm going to publish it in a form, you know, with a soft cover or a hard cover, but it needs to be done in a three-ring binder because the business plan always changes.
That's right. It's a living, breathing document.
Absolutely. And, you know, without a business plan and without a good executive summary, they don't present at my meetings.
So they have to have a completed business plan?
Absolutely.
You're not a fan of the one-page business plan?
No, really not. And, you know, it doesn't do them any good, even if they can pay the fee. Their chances of getting money are substantially reduced if they haven't thought through all of the issues involved in putting a business together and putting it forward. I can't help, you know, Susie's yogurt shop. She needs to go for a 7A SBA loan at the bank or find Uncle George. We are not Uncle George.
Right. And then so when you're doing the business plan, is there help for people who have never done a business plan? Do you recommend?
Yeah, there's software. GN is, I think, the best one. It's called Biz Plan Builder, group out of California that I use pretty regularly. And Office Max, Office Depot, Staples all has Biz Plan Builder.
And then you go just and work your way through the...
It's a piece of software that you just kind of click on the boxes and delete and add.
But when they're doing the financial projections, how does the firm project 3 years out when they don't even know what they're going to be doing 6 months out?
Well, I think they have to do some of that, and certainly with the help of a CPA or a strong MBA, they can get those projections done if they're a marketing person, and not everybody has all sets of skills.
And next Gathering of Angels, when is that?
It's on the 12th of November at the Georgian Club from 5 to 8. If folks are interested, they can register on my site. They have to fill out some forms for me. And I don't really allow nor encourage service providers to
come. Right, it's not for vendors. These are real investors.
I have PR people that call me. I have lawyers that say, well, can I come? And maybe I'll pick up a client. And I said, you know,
that's not the right venue for that.
You need to go to the Chamber of Commerce or some other wonderful place and drink wine there.
Right.
And if they don't write checks in two or three meetings, I'll take them off the list.
Really? So then you want serious investors that are looking to make deals.
That's the only way it works. I've had groups filled early when I came back to Atlanta with 60, 70, 80 people, and nobody wrote any checks. And
right.
I just started it again. I said, that's not the way we're going to do it. That doesn't help the presenters, and
right.
I have to pay the bill at the end. So that's not fun.
And then if somebody wants to learn more, the website?
www.gatheringofangels.com.
All right, Tarby, thank you so much for being part of the show.
My pleasure.
All right, next up, Jason Michaud with Mac Stadium. I know I said the name wrong. I apologize.
That's all right.
Tell us about Mac Stadium.
Well, about 3 years ago, I left my previous engagement as an entrepreneur and a technologist, which I've been doing that my whole life.
At Android Stadium?
No. I was in the telecom and service provider space for TCP, IP, networking, things of that nature. So I've been doing that my whole life, and I was ready for a change and looking for an underserved market in cloud services in particular. Cloud services, that word, I really despise it, but what it really means is infrastructure in a data center somewhere managed by a bunch of engineers.
How did the word cloud even get equated to that?
I really don't know. If you've been doing this as long as me, you've been dealing with data centers and infrastructure. It wasn't called a cloud 20 years ago, but now it is.
Some marketing guy probably came up with it.
I think the guy at Salesforce. about 3 years ago, intentionally left where I was at and decided to get into cloud services space with an underserved niche. I happen to have a friend here in Atlanta who owns and operates several data centers with a lot of excess capacity and an engineering team to go along with it. So he became my angel, if you will. And so far, he's funded the business with me. It's all been debt so far. And we've been growing like crazy. It started out to be to serve a kind of a hobbyist community. What makes Mac Stadium unique is that we use all Apple hardware. And people kind of think about that, and they're used to thinking about data centers full of HP, rack and stack servers, blade servers, big storage infrastructure. So we've got all that old stuff or traditional stuff, but we've also got thousands of Mac Mini servers and custom infrastructure inside this data center.
And what's the advantage of doing it that way?
Well, like I said, it started out as a hobbyist market. If you look at what, Apple's been around forever, and there's always been kind of this small percentage of the ecosystem that used Apple hardware, and they're always fanatics. So Started out as SMBs that wanted to get their server out of the closet, so to speak, and into a data center where you have 100% uptime, you know, super fast gigabit connectivity, security, cooling, all these things. So we provide that service starting at $34 a month. But what has happened since we launched is that we've the market has changed quite a bit, and as you guys know, everything is going mobile now. So the days of shipping CDs and DVDs to your customers, if you're a software company or a SaaS company, those days are completely over. So it's all about iPads, iPhones, and these companies that are writing software for the mobile marketplace, a lot of times that software, most times, has to work on iOS or OS X, which is Apple's software platforms. So if you're going to be writing software for iOS or OS X, you have to write it, develop it on Apple hardware. So Swift and Xcode and all these development platforms that software companies use only work on Apple hardware. And if you are a software company and let's say you've got developers in different countries around the world, or even maybe you have a team in one room, you want to have your development platform in a centralized location that's always on and in a very stable environment. So that's one niche that's growing very quickly for us. There's hundreds of thousands of Apple developers out there, or software developers that develop in iOS, and they need sometimes they can't even afford a Mac server, so we provide that server on a monthly basis for them in an always-on environment. As those companies grow, the other big market for us are the actual SaaS companies that need production infrastructure to run all that software, once they're in production. So most companies today will start out using a company like Amazon Web Services or Rackspace to get virtual infrastructure. So virtual infrastructure means you're getting a slice of some servers somewhere, and you typically don't know where those servers are, and you typically don't know where your data really is. So what we do at Mac Stadium is we do 100% dedicated infrastructure, and we try to price it at a point where you can actually have dedicated server infrastructure, whether that's one server or a cluster of 100 of them, for a price equivalent or less than what a virtual server would cost you elsewhere. And so what that gives the SaaS companies is a lot of value, number one, because if their software processes used to take 30 seconds, a lot of times it might take 10 seconds now. Mm-hmm. But the other real kicker is that a lot of times they have to have a portion of their software has to run iOS or OS X, and Amazon and Rackspace and none of these companies out there provide OS X or iOS hosting. It's right. A underserved niche right now. So Mac Stadium is the largest company of its type in the planet. We're as big as all of our competitors combined. And that is our specialty, is building relationships with software companies primarily, also SMBs. But we provide the infrastructure out the gate, and we through that partnership, we provide engineering services, and we build, design and build and deploy and operate scalable, dedicated infrastructure for those companies.
So like at Amazon, at their storage, they don't have a bunch of Mac servers.
They do not.
I know a lot of people use Macs, but we're going to pass.
Right. So most of our customers, to deal with the Mac portion of their business, they would either have a stack of Mac Minis in the CTO's closet, like 10 or 20 of them in their corporate office, right? And they're trying to find out where to put them, in which case they'll call us and say, hey, can you take these servers and get them out of here?
Put them in your office.
We're a software company. We're not an infrastructure company. We don't have network engineers. So they're happy to do that, and they're delighted to find a company like us that they can partner with. If we catch the companies early on enough, a lot of times they're raising capital, they've got a couple employees. Mm-hmm. They need us to help fund their infrastructure because they're not a funded company yet. Which that's effectively what we do with a month-to-month agreement.
Right.
And we have all the infrastructure there, thousands of servers, lots of engineering expertise.
Thousands of minis.
Thousands of Mac minis.
And it's really clever because the mini's got a much better graphics card.
Yeah.
So if you were to compare it with the traditional model, you're just not going to get the speeds.
Yeah. One of our biggest customers has hundreds of servers with us. And what drove them to the it started out with we serviced their OS X needs. And as soon as we got done doing that, they said, well, let's talk about our Windows stuff that was currently on AWS. And because it was all virtualized, there was no graphics co-processor. And to get a single virtualized instance on Amazon with a GPU, as they call it, a graphics co-processor, was hundreds of dollars per instance. So we did some testing, and 90 days later, we had hundreds of of Mac Minis running Windows, not OS X, in our data center, and they shut down all their Amazon stuff, and they cut their costs in half, and did much better on their production speeds.
So is the kind of the idea for the next few years just to grow as rapidly and as aggressively as possible before these guys realize that you've just done something that they really are not doing very well?
These guys meaning Amazon and Rackspace?
Yeah.
So we're seeing almost double-digit growth month over month right now. That's primarily coming from our software, our SaaS company partners. As they grow, we grow because we are baked into their business plan in most cases. We build that partnership early on, and as their software starts to grow and they need more infrastructure, they just pick up the phone and say, hey, I need 10% more. We turn it around in 24 hours, and they're ecstatic. So what they're asking us to do now is to go to different markets around the world.
It's going to say, how's the British doing? How close are we?
So yeah, one of the things about the internet is it's highly regulated by the speed of light, which you might think is, fast enough, but it takes 60 milliseconds to get from here to Europe, 200 milliseconds to get from here to India, and depending on your software application, that that lag creates packet loss and a lesser customer experience for that software company. So they're asking us to build out into Europe. We're doing a West Coast U.S. also, and eventually in Asia.
Exciting.
So,
so when did you know that this thing was going to take off? Like at first, like you said, this was a niche thing.
Yeah.
You had an idea and you convinced somebody to do this.
Well, there's a couple guys out there been doing this for the hobbyist community for 5 to 10 years. And I had a chance, I kind of stumbled into their operations and I saw what they were doing and I knew right away that they were doing it wrong and I could do better. So that's where the idea came from 3 years ago. My background's in operations and as a technologist. So before we lit our first customer, we spent 4 months writing software. And this is back-end software for automation, provisioning, ties to our billing systems. And the vision was to build this to multiple geographic regions, multiple data centers, tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of customers right out the gate. So we made a lot of investment in that before we even got started. And quite honestly, I knew we'd get some customers because I saw other people doing the hobbyist thing. What's really the big surprise is the growth of the Apple OS X and iOS marketplace, and because everything's going mobile. And I just got done watching Apple's new release today. The new Mac Mini just came out today, as of an hour ago. But everyone's, those guys are setting the pace. So this is not something that's going away. I think it's actually growing. Mm. And as more and more software companies come out and they need infrastructure partners, where we're at is a great place to be.
Do you have any proprietary technologies?
We do. Two things that make us proprietary. I think when customers come to the site, the first thing they can do is they can actually get a dedicated server on a 48-hour trial for free, and they can get it instantly. So if you're an Amazon customer, you're used to instant activation, as they call it, or you sign up, you get your virtual server within a matter of seconds. So with us, we actually give dedicated physical servers within a matter of seconds. So we wrote a lot of software to allow that. We have hundreds of servers pre-staged in the data center awaiting the customer's order. And that allows us to establish a relationship with curious people as they pass by, the Mac Stadium. They get in there, and more times than not, they're ecstatic about our customer service and the product offering, and those relationships in many cases will grow from one server to 5 servers to 100 servers. So that's I don't want to say we're the only company on the planet that does instant activation of dedicated servers, but I don't know of many. Mm. So that all that software is proprietary. Also, our infrastructure, all the racks that we built are all built specifically for the servers that we house. So typically in a data center, you would have a computer cabinet that would hold about 40 servers and use something like 60 amps of power for traditional HP or Dell servers. Our racks are custom built. They're 10 foot tall. They hold 460 servers per rack with about 100 amps of power. Wow. So it's almost a 10x increase in, if you want to call it green efficiency. Mm. So all that, for the Mac Mini, we also have a custom rack enclosure for the Mac Pro. That all that's been licensed. And so that's all custom infrastructure. The fact that we can provide you a dedicated server for about the price of a virtual server elsewhere, that is enabled through our efficiency in the back end. So the footprint of the Apple hardware, the reliability of the Apple hardware, everyone knows Apple makes great iPhones and iPads. Well, they also make great server hardware. Allows us to drive down our data center costs per customer and offer dedicated infrastructure at a much lower price than you would normally expect.
And how do you find you're growing quite quickly?
Yeah.
What's the biggest challenge technology-wise for you in the next 6 months, year?
Technology-wise? Well, a lot of our customers today are leveraging cloud offerings, which means we're taking a bunch of servers and we're creating what's called a private cloud for them in a cluster. We're doing that with VMware. Typically, we're a VMware partner. And so beyond the servers themselves, there's a lot of other infrastructure that goes along with that. So high-end SAN storage from EMC and NetApp, Cisco firewalls, load balancers, things like this that you would normally see in a big, you know, rack space type environment. So we have all that type infrastructure and the people that know how to operate it on staff as well. But these orders are all typically custom, right? And so trying to a big challenge is resisting doing custom deals and trying to fit these bigger solutions into a predefined container so we can scale the business.
Saying no, that's one of your challenges, saying no?
Saying no, which we don't do. So what we try to do is educate our customers, and that's really the biggest thing. You'll talk to people that have been doing, you know, IT for 20 years, and they think they know what the cloud is, and they think they know what virtualization is, but they don't know what a private cloud is. They don't know that they can take, you know, 50 VPSs and squeeze it down into three physical servers and have complete control over it. So we spend a lot of time educating our customers, and that's where a lot of the partnership comes from, is we open their eyes to the possibilities. We build that out for them and enable them, and then from there, you know, it's a win-win for both sides.
So you want to get rid of the term the cloud and just make everything a Mac Stadium?
Mac Stadium. unfortunately, we have to use the term. We call it private cloud is the technical term for it, where it's private infrastructure, but it's still in the cloud in the data center somewhere. Except you know exactly where it's at and you know where your data's at.
And if you press delete, you know it's deleted?
Yeah, you're responsible.
Because AWS is awful like that. They say it's kind of gone, but it's not.
Yeah, I mean, so if customers want to get set up for replication and backup services, we offer all that stuff and we'll train them how to use it. But if they delete it, they delete it. That's a big opportunity. And every time you see somebody like Dropbox gets hacked, you know, that came out a couple of days ago, 24 million accounts got exposed. Every time that happens, it empowers us because, you know, why would you want, if you're a business, you're not going to put your customer data in Dropbox. Where are you going to put it? You're going to put it in private cloud infrastructure where you control it. Mm-hmm. So,
what sort of revenue are you doing now? Is that proprietary?
And Tarby.
Yeah, he wants hard numbers.
Did he bring his checkbook? That's the question you can ask him.
That's what happens. You get these professors in here in finance. you don't have to answer. This is a safe place.
Millions of dollars a year.
I'm just curious. And your revenue model is subscription-based?
Yeah, it's recurring revenue. Okay. Typically, we don't use contracts. We just do a good job to make sure we keep the business. Yeah. And I think customers like that and appreciate that.
Bill them every month?
Yeah, it's recurring. And once you get them up and going, if you do it right, you don't hear from them very often, except if they want to grow their business. And so it is recurring. So every month, our focus is growing net new customers and net new revenue. Mm-hmm. The graph has never gone down. Okay. By a long shot. So.
So there is a virtualization layer on top of your servers, right? It's just so I can decide that I want to buy a whole server, but I'm still always running on top of the VMware hypervisor, right?
Not always. So when the low end product is what we call a dedicated server. That's a single Mac Mini, and you can choose whether you want OS X 10.8, 10.9, 10.10 now, Windows or VMware ESXi, which is a bare metal hypervisor.
Okay.
What I was thinking.
Yeah. So yeah, we can put the virtualization layer on there. VMware offers
both.
Yeah, and so as customers grow, we either walk them down one path, which is keep adding more and more Mac Minis running whatever OS you want in clusters without virtualization, or to add a virtualization layer. We typically use VMware, and in that case, they can get oversubscription. So you can run, you know, five OSXs per server instead of one.
Right.
It's and, not or. Right. Yeah. It's, yeah. You can have it your way. It's instead of choosing one or the other, right?
Yeah, and some people do both. And so we do Mac Minis. We also do a lot of other non-Mac infrastructure. So
yeah, sometimes and I can definitely appreciate that because you know we spend we're on budget to spend almost $400,000 a year with Amazon.
Right.
And you know they're great, but you know when you talk about databases and pulling out the actual like hard disk substrate from the database caused a lot of problems for us for a performance standpoint. We would love the ability to just say,
wow,
you know what, we'll virtualize everything, look but just this. Give us a dedicated server for the database because we need that hard drive and so I can live that pain.
Yeah, so a lot of times they'll come to us because they need the Mac stuff. They'll learn about who we are, what we do. We'll do a great job on the Mac stuff to earn their business, and the next conversation turns to, well, what about my other $40,000 a month I'm doing on Amazon for Windows and Linux? And the answer is, well, we can support you on that as well with, you know, HP Blade servers and, you know, big EMC storage and educate you on private cloud, train you. And, you know, you can tie these cloud systems right into Jenkins and, you know, your software development automation with APIs and everything. So that's what we do. Yeah.
And so the pain that the company is having is what? That they're saying, I got to call the Mac Stadium people.
Oh, our customers?
Yeah.
Well, I guess it depends. If it's a mature company, the pain that they're having is that they need somewhere to operate their OSX or iOS based SaaS solution, and they can't do it on Amazon or Rackspace. If it's an emerging software company, one or two guys working out of their apartment, it's that they need a single server so where they can collaborate and build their app. And they can't even afford to buy a $2,000 server, so for $50 a month, they can come here and build a relationship.
Good stuff. Now, if somebody wanted to learn more, website for you guys?
MacStadium.com. We have a great page on there, Enterprise Solutions. It talks about the higher-end stuff. Pretty much all the higher-end solutions start with a relationship and a conversation with somebody like myself. So,
good stuff. Well, thank you so much for being part of the show.
Thanks for having me. This is great.
James, what a show, huh?
I'm really impressed. Yeah, really good
companies
guys.
Here.
Yeah, really good. And I think it'd be fascinating to see where both, you know, obviously Toby as well, but you two, I think it'd be fascinating to see where you are in 2 years.
Yeah, just, Tarby couldn't get his checkbook out fast enough.
I kept asking the questions.
I know, you're
I'm not getting much.
All you can do is ask, right?
You don't ask, you don't get.
Well, thank everybody for being part of the show today, and especially Band of Coders. Without their support, this show would not exist. So please check them out at bandofcoders.com. This is Lee Cantor for James Douglas. We will see you all next time on Atlanta Technology Leaders.
Atlanta Technology Leaders is brought to you by Band of Coders. Band of Coders is a company of talented software developers who energize clients' projects and their development teams.